You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CJSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
Build cities, build communities in a way that people can get more of what they need closer at hand and can walk and bike as much as possible and occasionally use subways and light rail and buses. And basically, I think what we need to be moving towards is more leisure time, is less formal work, less work that's just about production and more consumption.
That's the voice of Yves Engler. In this week's show, we speak to Yves about his new book, Stop Signs, Cars, and Capitalism. On the last show of the year, we talked to Yves about transitioning from a car culture to a more ecologically friendly culture that puts people first. So stay tuned.
Someone who has done a lot of work helping us not only look critically at our past, where our present is leading, is my next guest. Yves Engler is an amazing author. He's written many books. His latest book is Stop Signs, Cars and Capitalism on the Road to Economic, Social and Ecological Decay. It was co-authored by Yves Engler and Bianca Mugenji. We're very privileged to have Yves Engler on our program. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Sylvia.
Now, in your book, which it's amazingly timely, you know, faced with the ecological crisis and the irresponsible behavior of our present government in Canada, you talk about the impact of pollution and global warming. Can you talk a little bit about some of the impacts the car has on our society and the long-term impact of pollution, if left unchecked?
Yeah, well, I mean, right now, basically, humanity is facing a serious ecological crisis. Most importantly, with regards to human-induced climate change, there are numbers suggest that as many as 150,000 people are already dying every year because of changing climate. But those numbers are expected to increase massively over the coming years. One study suggests about 1 million people a year by 2030. The countries that are emitting the most CO2 per person, countries like Canada, the U.S., are actually those who are set to not feel the most impact. And in the countries, particularly in Africa, that are not responsible for the emissions are feeling the most impact already and expected to be the main victims going forward. So just on the level of global warming, I think there is, the private automobile is incredibly destructive. But even just at the level of, you know, Canadians' health, all the pollutants that come out of the car are tied to an incredible number of diseases, cancers, asthma, the list goes on in terms of dozens and dozens of studies that show that the different pollutants living near a highway or a major roadway increases your chance of a whole series of different diseases that are deadly to the population. So the private automobile is incredibly destructive in terms of human health, and yet our economic and political system makes it such that people are pushed to drive to use this very destructive form of transportation.
Now let's talk a little bit about that, because in your book you point about the role of subsidies in maintaining this very unsustainable industry. Can we talk about the impact that this has had, and what other economic development could be pursued? What other opportunities are being bypassed because we're dumping all our money in, you know, producing gasoline automobiles instead of perhaps transportation, affordable transportation?
First of all, in terms of subsidies, the subsidies are just basically endless, from the national government standpoint right down to the local government. And if you look at different municipalities, how much of their budget is spent on repairing roads, building roads, it varies obviously in every municipality, but often it's the biggest chunk of the city budget that goes to building roads or repairing roads, or in the case of colder cities, in terms of getting rid of snow. It's an incredible amount of city budgets, and there'll be often there's a discussion about building a bike path, and that's going to cost $10 million, and there will be a big hue and cry about the bike path, about the cost of the bike path, when it's pennies next to building even just a kilometer worth of roadway for cars. But in terms of what could be done, if we chose a different path, if we chose to seriously move beyond the private automobile, what could happen with all the resources that are currently pumped into roadway? Well, the sky's the limit in terms of what could be done. But I think ultimately part of what moving beyond the private automobile should be about is increasingly moving towards active forms of transportation, i.e. walking and biking, to build cities, build communities in a way that people can get more of what they need closer at hand, and can walk and bike as much as possible, and occasionally use subways and light rail and buses. And basically, I think what we need to be moving towards is more leisure time, is less formal work, less work that's just about production and more consumption, which is, I think, ultimately what the private automobile is about. It's an incredible consumerist good, and move more towards a different sort of conception of what life is about, rather than just being about working to buy, maybe to for human beings to fulfill themselves in other ways, in terms of pursuing arts, pursuing political activity, pursuing educational activity, etc. But concretely, in the very short term, the money that cities put into automobile infrastructure could very easily go into improving bike paths, in terms of improving transportation, beautifying neighborhoods, communities, building more parks or other things that improve community life.
Now, our lives are in many ways constructed through the narratives we tell, and one of the narratives we hear is that this industry is very efficient, and all of the things that we're discussing are sort of clouded or at least blurred over by a very deliberate advertising machinery. We hear in the media, we hear in our schools, there's this almost concerted effort to imagine this kind of development, industrial development, as the only way of possibly conceiving society. And the automobile has become this sort of iconic figure of how we see society. Can you talk a little bit about this systemic hegemony that enables this myth of efficiency to continue in the face of, the tar sand oil, in the face of, the millions of accidents that happen every year?
Well, the auto industry has, one of the brilliance of the auto industry is, for at least a century now, more than a century, they have worked very rigorously to promote their products in all forms of communication, from getting themselves inserted into pop songs to incredible amount of formal advertising in newspapers, TV, magazines, etc. They're by far the biggest advertisers. No industry comes close to the auto industry in terms of advertising, and that plays itself out in every different possible mode in terms of inserting themselves into TV shows, product placements in video games, to throwing parties where it's just a really big advertisement for a certain brand of car. The list is endless. And so they have been successful in creating a want for their product, in creating a status symbol for their product. So we live in a society today where everybody who's a little bit serious about the matter understands that cars, the private automobile, is a major contributor to significant ecological destruction. And yet, so on one hand, that will be sort of accepted pretty broadly, but at the other hand, there is still this belief that one is successful if they have a 5,000-pound SUV that spews, that consumes however many liters of gas for every 10 kilometers it drives. So there's a real a disconnect between, on one hand, knowing this being a very destructive product, on the other hand, people seeing fulfillment and seeing a high status that comes with having a Hummer, for instance. And I think that the only explanation for that disconnect, or the main explanation for that disconnect, is the cultural assault pushed by the automakers in terms of convincing us that life is better, that their status is higher if they, drive this product. Any thinking about it should be that the status of somebody driving a 6,000-pound vehicle should be at the lowest. You should think that this is the most inhumane, anti-Earth thing to do. But the sort of morality of car company-induced advertising world is such that the situation is reversed, where those who are doing the most in terms of destroying the environment are sort of seen as they have this, fancy Porsche that has incredibly destructive gas mileage, is seen as, a very positive thing. The person on the bike is seen as somehow, the loser. And I think that's really something that's been pushed very strongly by the auto sector.
One of the arguments you would hear is that, okay, that may be the case for people who have money and can afford to buy a Hummer, but come on, let's talk about jobs. We're in the middle of an economic crisis and we need jobs. What would you say to people that tell you we need the auto industry because it employs people?
Well, first of all, there is no denying that the auto sector, historically at least, has provided, in North America, has provided a fairly substantial number of, for at least a lot of years, where we're quite well-paying working-class jobs. There is no denying that. That has changed a lot. The automation that's taken place in the production of automobiles has led to many fewer people being hired in manufacturing the car. So there is an element of truth to that, and there's also an element of truth to the simple inefficiency of the automobile has led to more work, because it's inefficient at the level of needing a 3,000-pound vehicle to take a 200-pound person around. Also, it necessitates just incredible amount of laying of asphalt in terms of building highway, in terms of building roadway. There is no doubt there have been lots of jobs that have been created with the automobile and the whole society structured around the automobile, and there can be lots of jobs to build alternative forms of transportation. Certainly, building and operating buses can create lots of jobs. Similarly, with regards to light rail, other forms of mass transportation. Likewise, in terms of building bike paths or even building bikes. But I think the reality is, ultimately, if you are moving towards increased active transportation, it is true that what you're doing is you're moving the work of the transportation from those producing automobiles to those who are walking, those who are biking. There is no doubt that at some level you're moving towards less formal employment. That is why I think that in the longer term, I think in the medium term, there's lots of jobs that can be created in terms of building alternative forms of transportation. And in some cases, restructuring of cities that needs to take place to move beyond the private automobile, there's lots of jobs that will be needed in that process. But I think ultimately it is true. There will be less jobs in a city structured more around walking and biking than there is in one structured around the automobile. The question becomes, is the point of an economic system or society just to create work just for the sake of creating work, was the point of a society should be to, or a transportation system for that matter, should it be to make for the best form of transportation system, so the healthiest, so people, you know, get the most exercise, you know, least amount of pollutants that they suck into their lungs, the least amount of damage to the environment, or is it just about, you know, creating work? And in fact, it's never really been about creating work. The reason why the automobile sector has been popular is not because it's created work, it's because it's created profits. It's not, work has been a byproduct of the, you know, promotion of the corporations. It's the profits that the corporations are really what they're looking at, and that's why they push the automobile. But I think that part of moving beyond the private automobile in the long term is about shifting our whole understanding of what, you know, a transportation system should be about. Should it be about profits, or should it be about what's the healthiest, what's the most livable, what's the best form of transportation for society and for the individual? And I think that that's very clearly one where people aren't dependent upon 3,000-pound vehicles to get around.
That's a really important point. I would say that in a capitalist society, the impetus will always be profits, not what we need. That has been demonstrated. But I want to talk a little bit about the other externalities, because, you know, when we talk about the accidents, the kinds of pollutions that we're exposed to, the increasing amount of cancers, asthma incidents among children under the age of 5, all of those things are things that are not in the equation of what it costs to create an automobile. But even outside of that realm is the kinds of wars that are being fought to secure resources. And here I want to talk a little bit about the oil industry and its connection to the automobile industry. Can you talk about why we should be aware of that externality cost and how this, I don't know, incestuous relationship between oil companies and auto manufacturers are continuously propagating and perpetuating conflict worldwide?
Well, I mean, I just think, first of all, you know, people talk about, in the official media, they talk about how, you know, we need this tar sands because there's a need for this oil. We need the tar sands development because there's a need for oil. Well, yes, if we're going to keep everything as is, there is a certain good truth that there is, if we're going to use all the most inefficient forms of transportation, we're going to basically use oil like it's, like there's no negative byproduct of it, then yes, so then there is need for, you know, new sources of oil. But if we move away from just this constant expansion of oil-based transportation, most importantly, but and others, then there isn't the need for oil. So that means that if we were to move towards a new different forms of transportation, the oil that's sitting in the tar sands that emits incredible amounts of CO2 emissions in the production phase, that it destroys, you know, it's leading increased cancer rates for First Nations communities in Fort Chipewyan and elsewhere. If we were to move to a different form of transportation, then there would be, we could keep that oil in the ground like it should stay, and, you know, the tar sands could simply be shut down like it should be. Similarly, you go elsewhere in the world, you could look at just recently in the Niger Delta. In our book, we have a chapter or a section that deals with the oil extraction in the Niger Delta, and this incredible social conflict and the destruction of communities that has come with that. Just a couple of days ago, Shell again released, they're claiming, for, I think, 40,000 barrels of oil spill in Niger Delta. The people there are saying that's probably an underestimate, and we don't know exactly, but another terrible oil spill, and this is just one of a long list of terrible oil spills that Shell has been responsible for, and basically didn't get any attention in the North American, very little attention in the North American media. But it, you know, it's obviously very destructive for the communities that are dependent upon fishing, for instance, for their livelihoods in the Niger Delta, and, you know, and different other human and environmental costs from this oil spill. Well, that's partly tied, the fact that Shell is extracting oil in such a destructive way, that's partly tied to the vehicles that we're driving. Additionally, you look at the geopolitics of oil and all the struggle going on right now in terms of Iran and in terms of work to undermine the government in Venezuela, the attempt to overthrow the government in Venezuela going back to April 2002. I wouldn't say these geopolitics are not simply about extracting oil, but part of what's going on there is a geopolitics of oil that is tied to this very inefficient form of transportation that we have, which is the private automobile and how much of the oil it consumes. It's something like 2/3 to 75% of the oil in North America is consumed by either private automobiles or trucks moving goods. So this is partly tied, the different the pressure points, the building of army bases, U.S. army bases all around the world, and actually now increasingly Canadian army bases, is partly tied to this oil policy, which is tied again to the form of transportation. So I think that yes, you can't divorce the transportation decisions made in Vancouver from the attempts to undermine governments that happen to have lots of oil, the case of Libya or the case of Venezuela or elsewhere.
We no longer talk about class. We no longer talk about how the wealth has concentrated on a very small percentage of people. In Canada, the stats said that it's like 248,000 people that literally own, more than 40% of all our total assets. One of the interesting things that comes to mind is, being Christmas, people often think about the role of companies as, philanthropy and how they contribute and give back to the community. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that, because under this philanthropy capitalism, many of these companies like the Tarsons, the GMs of the world, get away with continuing their rabid practices and at the same time get tax reductions for their meager donations to, projects. Can you talk about this?
Well, for sure. I mean, the example in Vancouver that's received SFU Gold Corps' role in funding center at SFU, I guess probably a year ago, lots of controversy around that. But yes, basically the model that the rich of society that they would like to see is not that there are social entitlements that say that just because one is a human being born into the society that they for have a right to access to healthcare or to public parks or to education or whatever, but rather what the rich would prefer is a model where they get to decide what is funded, right? And so they don't have a problem, like somebody who has $1 billion, there's no need on a personal level, there's absolutely no need to have $1 billion. You couldn't spend $1 billion if you wanted to spend $1 billion in terms of your personal buying food. You can only buy so many fancy meals. But what they want is to be able to decide what institutions get funding and what institutions don't get funding. It's a question of power. And people like Peter Munk, the head of Barrick Gold, one of the richest Canadians, billionaire, he's very explicit about this. And he actually had a very interesting interview in the Maclean's a few months back where he was just very clear about his vision of what philanthropy is about. And he's given supposedly over $100 million to different initiatives, mostly in Toronto. One of the most controversial initiatives that he's been involved in funding in his philanthropy is the Monk Center at the University of Toronto. He's put, I don't know what exact number now, but $20, $25 million into the Monk Center. And it's a institute at the University of Toronto focused on foreign policy and discussion of international relations. And he's worked it to a situation where he has an immense amount of influence over the over the institute. And so he has a certain level of control over, sort of who gets hired and how the institute functions, giving him a whole lot of power over foreign policy discussion. It's one of only a couple of these international affairs-oriented institutions and Canadian universities. So giving him a whole lot of power over how foreign policy discussion is conducted in Canada. By chance, his companies happen to be operating all around the world, and foreign policy, Canadian foreign policy, is something that's very important in terms of how his companies are able to operate and able to, or his company is able to operate and able to make money. So I think from the standpoint of the rich, the philanthropy model of society, a society based upon charity, not based upon social rights and social entitlements, that say that because I was born in the society, I have the entitlement to a basic education, I have the entitlement to a health coverage, but rather one that, because they want a system, one, because some rich person has decided that they're going to spend $20 million on a public park, you know, therefore people can have some access to that public park. Not that government and society should build that public park so everyone has access to it, but rather that some rich person is going to have the goodwill, and then they'll get credit, and they'll have their name marked, and we'll all bow down to whatever rich person as the great savior. And I think that from the standpoint of social justice, the charity model of rich people being able to decide what is of social use and what isn't of social use is of course inherently anti-democratic. It is basically saying the small few can decide what society needs, and the majority just have to go along with whatever the small few decide. So I think that the model that has been pushed by progressive-minded political movements probably forever, but certainly in the past century, is one that says we will tax the richest at higher rates, and we'll use that money for social entitlements to expand our healthcare system, to expand our educational system, and that is one that works much better. It's much more just. It leads to a healthier and more educated population. But over the past two decades, 25 years, there's been a real counterattack from the wealthier sectors towards a model that's more focused on sort of charity giving, and that rich people get to decide what is good for society. And I think that that's something that movements like the Occupy movement, movements that have grown up, certainly in the past, this past year, 2011, seen lots of democratic movements from the Arab world to Europe to Chilean students and to the Occupy movement. I think that a big part in all those movements is moving away from this idea that rich people should be deciding everything, saying that we want some economic democracy. We want one person, one vote, not just in the political realm, but also in the economic realm.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much for being with us. I think that's a great place to end. Your book, Stop Signs, Cars and Capitalism on the Road to Economic, Social and Ecological Decay. How can people access your book?
Local independent bookstores should be available. Online through my website, evengler.com, which is YVESENGLER.com.
Thank you again.
We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the U.S. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.